5. She really was the person who came closest to being the heart of the town, and that may have been why she was one of the first to feel the change. It began with a headache and bad dreams. The headache came in with the month of July. Sometimes it was so faint she barely noticed it. Then, without warning, it would swell to a thick, throbbing beat behind her forehead. It was so bad on the night of July 4th that she called Christina McKean, with whom she had planned to go see the fireworks in Bangor, and begged off. She went to bed that night with light still lingering in the sky outside, but it was dark before she was finally able to drift off to sleep. She supposed the heat and humidity were keeping her awake. They would keep people awake all over New England that night, she reckoned, and this wasn't the first night that had been like this. It had been one of the stillest, hottest summers in her memory. She dreamed of fireworks. Only these fireworks were not red and white and coruscating orange. They were all a dull and terrible green. They burst across the sky in starbursts of light, only instead of going out, the starfish shapes in the sky oozed together and became huge sores. Looking around, she saw people she had lived with all her life. Harleys and Crenshaws and Browns and Duplessis and Andersons and Clarendons, staring up at the sky, their faces rotted swamp fire green. They stood in front of the post office, the drugstore, the junkatorium, the Haven Lunch, the Northern National Bank. They stood in front of the school and the Shell station, eyes filled with green fire, mouths hanging stupidly agape. Their teeth were falling out. Justin Hurd turned to her and grinned, lips pulling back to show bare pink gums. In the crazy light of her dream, the saliva streaking those gums looked like snot.
"Feels good,"
Justin lisped, and she thought, "Get out of here. They all have to get out of here right now. If they don't, they are going to die the same way Ralph did." Now Justin was walking toward her, and she saw with mounting horror that his face was shriveling and changing. It was becoming the bulging, stitched face of Lumpkin, her scarecrow doll. She looked around wildly and saw that they had all become dolls. Mabel Noyes turned and stared at her, and Mabel's blue eyes were as calculating and avaricious as ever, but her lips were plumped up in the Cupid's bow smile of a china doll.
"Tommyknockers,"
Mabel lisped in a chiming, echoing voice, and Ruth woke up with a gasp, wide-eyed in the dark. Her headache was gone, at least for the time being. She came out of the dream directly into wakefulness with the thought, "Ruth, you have to leave right now. Don't even take time to pack a bag. Just pull on some clothes, get in the dark, and go." But she could not do that. Instead, she lay down again. After a long time, she slept. 6. When the report came in that the Paulsons' house was burning, the Haven Volunteer Fire Department turned out, but they were surprisingly slow about it. Ruth was there 10 minutes before the first pumper showed up. She would have torn Dick Allison's head off when he finally showed up, except she had known both of the Paulsons were dead. And, of course, Dick Allison had known, too. That was why he hadn't bothered to hurry, but that did not make Ruth feel a bit better. Quite the opposite. That knowing, now, what exactly was that? Ruth didn't know what it was. Even grasping the fact of the knowing was almost impossible. On the day the Paulsons' house burned, Ruth realized that she had been knowing things she had no right to know for a week or more. But it seemed so natural. It didn't come with trumpets and bells. The knowing was as much a part of her, of everyone in Haven now, as the beat of her heart. She no more thought about it than she thought about her heartbeat thudding softly and steadily in her ears. Only she had to think about it, didn't she? Because it was changing Haven. And the changes were not good. 7. Some few days before David Brown disappeared, Ruth realized with dull, dawning dismay that she had been ostracized by the town. No one spat at her when she walked down the street in the morning from her house to her office in the town hall. No one threw stones. She sensed much of the old kindness in their thoughts, but she knew people were turning to follow her progress as she walked. She did this with her head up, her face serene, just as if her head wasn't throbbing and pounding like a rotted tooth, just as if she hadn't spent the previous night, and the one before that, and the one before that, and tossing and turning, dozing into horrible, half-remembered dreams, and then clawing her way out again. They were watching her, watching and waiting
for what?
But she knew. They were waiting for her to become. 8. In the week between the fire at the Paulsons and Hilly's second gala magic show, things began to go wrong for Ruth. The mail, now that was one thing. She kept on getting bills and circulars and catalogs, but there were no letters. No personal mail of any kind. After 3 days of this, she took a stroll down to the post office. Nancy Voss only stood behind the counter like a lump, looking at her expressionlessly. By the time Ruth finished speaking, she thought she could actually feel the weight of the boss woman's stare. It felt like 2 small dusty stones were lying on her face. In the silence, she could hear something in the office humming and making spider-like scritching noises. She had no idea what it,
except it sorts the mail for her,
might be, but she didn't like the sound of it. And she didn't like being here with this woman because she had been sleeping with Joe Paulson, and she had hated Becca and... Hot outside. Hotter still in here. Ruth felt sweat break out over her body.
Have to fill out a mail complaint form, Nancy Voss said in a slow, inflectionless voice.
She slid a white card across the counter.
Here you go, Ruth.
Her lips pulled back in a cheerless grin. Ruth saw half the woman's teeth were gone. From behind them in the silence, scratch, scratch, scritchy, scratch, 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 scritchy, scratch. Ruth began to fill out the form. Sweat darkened big circles around the armpits of her dress. Outside, the sun beat steadily down on the post office parking lot. It was 90 in the shade, had to be, and not a breath of wind stirring, and Ruth knew the paving in that lot would be so soft that you could tear off a chunk with your fingers if you wanted and begin to chew it. State the nature of your problem, the form read.
I'm going crazy, she thought. That is the nature of my problem. Also, I am having my first menstrual period in 3 years.
In a firm hand, she began to write that she had gotten no first-class mail for a week and wished for the matter to be looked into.
Scratch, scratch, scritchy, scratch.
What's that noise? She asked without looking up from the form. She was afraid to look up.
Mail sorting gadget,
Nancy droned.
I thought it up.
She paused.
But you know that, don't you, Ruth?
How could I know a thing like that unless you told me? Ruth asked, and with a tremendous effort she made her voice pleasant. The pen she was using trembled and blotted the form, not that it mattered. Her mail wasn't coming because Nancy Voss was throwing it out. That was part of the knowing, too. But Ruth was tough. Her face remained clear and firm. She met Nancy's eyes directly, although she was afraid of that dusty black gaze, afraid of its weight.
Go on and speak up,
Ruth's gaze said.
I am not afraid of the likes of you. Speak up. But if you expect me to scutter away squeaking like a mouse, get ready for a surprise.
Nancy's gaze wavered and dropped. She turned away.
Call me when you get the card filled out,
she said.
I've got too much work to do to just stand around shooting the breeze. Since Joe died, the work's piled up out of all season. That's probably why your mail isn't...
Get out of town, you bitch. Get out while we'll still let you go.
Coming just on time, Mrs. McCausland.
Do you think so? Keeping her voice light and pleasant now required a superhuman effort. Nancy's last thought had slammed into her like an uppercut. It had been as bright and clear as a lightning stroke. She looked down at the complaint form and saw a large black...
tumor.
Blot spreading over it. She crumpled it and threw it away. Scritch, scritch, scratch. The door opened behind her. She turned and saw Bobby Anderson come in. Hello, Bobby, she said.
Hello, Ruth.
Go on, she's right. Get out while you still can, while you're still allowed. Please, Ruth, we most of us bear you no ill will.
Are you working on a new novel, Bobby? Ruth could now barely keep the tremor out of her voice. Hearing thoughts was bad. It made you think you were insane and hallucinating it. Hearing such a thing from Bobby Anderson...
While you're still allowed.
Of all people. Bobby Anderson, who was just about the kindest...
I didn't hear anything like that,
she thought, and grasped the idea with a sort of tired eagerness.
I was mistaken, that's all.
Bobby opened her postbox and took out a bundle of mail. She looked at her and smiled. Ruth saw she had lost a molar on the bottom left and a canine on the top right.
Better go now, Ruth, she said gently. Just get in your car and go, don't you think so?
Then she felt herself steady. In spite of her fear and her throbbing head, she steadied. Never, she said. This is my town. And if you know what's going on, tell the others that know what's going on not to push me. I have friends outside of Haven, friends that will listen to me seriously no matter how crazy what I'm saying might sound. They would listen for my late husband's sake, if not for my own. As for you, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. This is your town, too. It used to be, anyway. For a moment she thought Bobby looked confused and a little ashamed. Then she smiled sunnily, and there was something in that girlish, gap-toothed grin that scared Ruth more than anything else. It was no more human than a trout's grin. She saw Bobby in this woman's eyes, and had certainly felt her in her thoughts. But there was nothing of Bobby in the grin.
"Whatever you want, Ruth," she said. "Everyone in Haven loves you, you know. I think in a week or two, three at the outside, you'll stop fighting. I just thought I'd offer you the option. If you decide to stay, though, that's fine. In a little while, you'll be just fine."
9. She stopped in Cooter's for Tampax. There were none. No Tampax, no Modest, no Stay Free Maxis or Minis, no generic pads or tampons. A hand-lettered sign read, "New shipment arrives tomorrow. Sorry for any inconvenience." 10. On July 15th, a Friday, she began having problems with her office phone. In the morning, it was just an annoyingly loud hum, which she and the person she was talking to had to shout over. By noon, a crackling noise had been added. By 2 p.m., it had gotten so bad that the phone was useless. When she got home, she found that the phone there wasn't noisy at all. It was just smoothly and completely dead. She went next door to the Fannins to call the phone company's repair number. Wendy Fannin was making bread in her kitchen, kneading one batch of dough while her mixer worked a second batch. Ruth saw, with a weary lack of surprise, that the mixer wasn't plugged into the wall, but into what looked like an electronic game with its cover off. It was generating a strong glow as Wendy mixed her bread.
"Sure, go ahead and use the phone," Wendy said. "You know..."
"Get out, Ruth, get out of Haven."
"Where it is, don't you?"
"Yes," she said. She started toward the hall, then paused. "I stopped at Cooter's Market. I needed sanitary napkins, but they're all out."
"I know."
Wendy smiled, showing three gaps in a smile which had been flawless a week before. "I got the second to last box. It will be over soon. We'll become a little more, and that part will end."
"Is that so?" Ruth said.
"Oh, yes," Wendy said, and turned back to her bread.
The Fannin's phone was working just fine. Ruth was not surprised. The office girl at New England Contel said they would send a man right out. Ruth thanked her, and on her way out she thanked Wendy Fannin.
"Sure," Wendy said, smiling. "Whatever you want, Ruth. Everyone in Haven loves you, you know."
Ruth shuddered in spite of the heat. The telephone repair crew came and did something to the connection on the side of Ruth's house. Then they ran a test. The phone worked perfectly. They drove away. An hour later, the phone stopped working again. On the street that evening, she felt a rising whisper of voices in her brain. Thoughts as light as leaves kicked into a momentary rustle by a breath of October wind.
"Our Ruth. We love you, all Haven loves, but go if you go or change. If you stay, no one wants to hurt you, Ruth, so get out or stay. Yes, get out or stay, but leave us. Yes, leave us alone, Ruth, don't interfere. Let us be, become. Yes, let us become. Let us alone to become."
She walked slowly, head throbbing with voices. She glanced into the Haven lunch. Beach Jernigan, the short order cook, raised a hand to her. Ruth raised one in return. She saw Beach's mouth move, clearly forming the words, "There she goes." Several men at the counter turned around and waved. They smiled. She saw empty gaps where teeth had been not long ago. She passed Cooter's Market. She passed the United Methodist Church. Ahead of her now was the town hall with its square brick clock tower. The hands of the clock stood at 7:15. 7:15 of a summer night, and all over Haven men would be opening cold beers and turning radios to the voice of Ned Martin and the sound of Red Sox warm-up. She could see Bobby Tremaine and Stephanie Colson walking slowly toward the edge of town along Route 9, hand in hand. They had been going together for 4 years, and it really was a wonder Stephanie wasn't pregnant yet, Ruth thought. Just a July evening, with twilight coming on. Everything normal. Nothing was normal. Hilly Brown and Barney Applegate came out of the library, Hilly's little brother David trailing behind them like the tail of a kite. She asked to see what books the boys had gotten, and they showed her readily enough. Only in little David Brown's eyes had she seen a hesitant acknowledgement of the panic she felt, and felt it in his mind. That she felt his fear and did nothing about it was the main reason she drove herself so hard when the little boy disappeared 2 days later. Someone else might have justified it, might have said, "Look, I had enough on my own plate without worrying about what was dished onto David Brown's." But she wasn't the sort of woman who could find any comfort in such loud defensiveness. She had felt that boy's low terror. Worse, she had felt his resignation, his sureness that nothing could stop events, that they would simply wind along their preordained course from bad to worse. And as if to prove him right, hey presto, David was gone. And like the boy's grandfather, Ruth shouldered her share of the guilt. At the town hall, she turned and walked back to her house, keeping her face pleasant, in spite of her drilling headache, in spite of her dismay. The thoughts swirled and rustled and danced.
"Love you, Ruth. We can wait, Ruth.
Shh, shh, go to sleep. Yes, go to sleep and dream. Dream of things, dream of ways to become, ways to become, ways to..."
She went into her house and locked the door behind her and went upstairs and pressed her face into her pillow. Dream of ways to become. Oh, God, she wished she knew exactly what that meant. If you go, you go. If you stay, you change. She wished she knew, because whatever it meant, whether she wanted it or not, it was happening to her. No matter how much she resisted, she was also becoming.
"Yes, Ruth, yes. Sleep. Dream. Think. Become. Yes, Ruth, yes."
These thoughts, rustling and alien, followed her down into sleep, and then funneled away into darkness. She lay crosswise on the big bed, fully dressed, and slept deeply. When she woke, her body was stiff, but her mind felt clear and refreshed. Her headache had blown away like smoke. Her period, so oddly undignified and shameful after she had thought that was finally over for good, had stopped. For the first time in almost 2 weeks, she felt herself. She would have a long, cool shower and then set about getting to the bottom of this. If what it took was outside help, okay. If she had to spend a few days or a few weeks with people thinking she was off her rocker, so be it. She had spent her life building a reputation for sanity and trustworthiness, and what good would such a reputation be if it couldn't convince people to take you seriously when you sounded nuts? As she began to take off her sleep-rumpled dress, her fingers suddenly froze on the buttons. Her tongue had found an empty place in the line of her bottom teeth. There was a dull, distant pain there. Her eyes dropped to the coverlet of the bed. On it, where her head had been, she saw the tooth that had fallen out in the night. Suddenly nothing seemed simple anymore. Nothing at all. Ruth was aware that her headache had returned. 11. There was even hotter weather in store for Haven. In August, there would be a week when temperatures would crack the 100-degree mark every single day. But in the meantime, the July stretch of hot and muggy, which ran from the 12th through the 19th, was more than enough for everyone in town, thank you very much. The streets shimmered. The leaves on the trees hung limp and dusty. Sounds carried in the still air. Bobby Anderson's old truck, now rebuilt into a digging machine, could be heard clearly in Haven Village for most of that 8-day hot spell. People knew something important was going on out there at the old Frank Garrick place, important for the whole town. But no one mentioned it out loud any more than they mentioned the fact that it had driven Justin Hurd, Bobby's nearest neighbor, quite mad. Justin was building things. It was part of his becoming. But because he had gone crazy, some of the stuff he built was potentially dangerous. One of them was a thing that set up harmonic waves in the Earth's crust, waves which could possibly trigger an earthquake big enough to tear the state wide open and send the eastern half sliding into the Atlantic. Justin had made this harmonic wave machine to get the goddamn rabbits and woodchucks out of their burrows. They were eating all his fucking lettuces. I'll shake the little bastards out, he thought. Beach Jernigan went out to Justin's place one day while Justin was out harrowing up the crops in his west field. He plowed under 12 acres of corn that day, sweating profusely, lips pulled back in a constant maniacal grimace as he worried about saving 3 rows of lettuces, and dismantled the gadget, which consisted of cannibalized stereo components. When Justin returned, he would find his gadget gone, perhaps assume the goddamn chucks and rabbits had stolen it, and maybe set about rebuilding it. In which case, Beach or someone else would dismantle it again, or maybe, if they were lucky, he would feel called upon to build something less dangerous. The sun rose each day in a sky the color of pallid china, and then seemed to hang at the roof of the world. Behind the Haven lunch, a line of dogs lay in the scant shade of the overhanging eave, panting, even too hot to scratch fleas. The streets were mostly deserted. Every now and then someone would travel through Haven on his way up to or back from Derry and Bangor. Not too many, though, because the turnpike was so much quicker. Those who did pass through noticed an odd and sudden improvement in radio reception. One startled truck driver on Route 9, because he had gotten bored with I-95, tuned in a rock station which turned out to be broadcasting from Chicago. 2 old folks, bound for Bar Harbor, found a classical music station from Florida. This eerie, bell-clear reception faded when they were clear of Haven again. Some through travelers experienced more unpleasant side effects, headaches and nausea mostly, sometimes severe nausea. This was most commonly blamed on road food gone punky in the heat. A little boy from Quebec, headed for Old Orchard Beach with his parents, lost 4 baby teeth in the 10 minutes it took for the family station wagon to pass from one side of Haven to the other. The little boy's mother swore in French that she had never seen anything like it in her life. That night, in an Old Orchard Beach motel, the tooth fairy took them, and only one had been loose, the little boy's mother declared, and replaced them with a dollar. A mathematician from MIT, headed up to UMO for a 2-day conference on semi-logical numbers, suddenly realized that he was on the verge of grasping an entirely new way of looking at mathematics and mathematical philosophy. His face went gray, his perspiring skin suddenly cold, as he grasped with perfect clarity how such a concept could quickly produce proof that every even number over 2 is the sum of 2 prime numbers, how the concept could be used to trisect the angle, how it could... He pulled over, scrambled out of his car, and threw up in the ditch. He stood trembling and weak-kneed over the mess, which contained one of his canines, although he was just then much too excited to realize he'd lost a tooth, his fingers itching to hold a piece of chalk, to cover a blackboard with sines and cosines. Visions of the Nobel Prize jittered in his overheated brain. He threw himself back into his car and began to drive toward Orono again, punching his rusty Subaru up to 80. By the time he got to Hampden, his glorious vision had clouded over. And by the time he reached Orono, there was nothing left but a glimmer. He supposed it had been a momentary heat stroke. Only the vomiting had been real. That he could smell on his clothes. During the first day of the conference, he was pale and silent, offering little, mourning his glorious, ephemeral vision. That was also the morning Mabel Noyes became an unperson while puttering in the basement of the Junkatorium. It would not have been correct to say that she killed herself by accident or died by misadventure. Neither of those phrases exactly explained what had happened to her. Mabel didn't put a bullet in her head while cleaning a gun or stick a finger in an electrical socket. She simply collapsed her own molecules and winked out of existence. It was quick and not a bit messy. There was a flash of blue light and she was gone. Nothing was left but one smoldering bra strap and a gadget that looked like a silver polisher. That, in fact, was exactly what the gadget was supposed to be. Mabel thought it would make a dirty, tiresome job much easier, and wondered why she had never made such a gadget before, or why, for goodness sake, there weren't places where you could buy them, since it was a perfectly easy thing to make, and those gooks over there in Korea could probably turn them out by the ton. God knew the Korea gooks turned enough other things out by the ton, although she supposed she ought to just be grateful, since the Jap gooks had apparently gotten too uppity to do the little stuff. She had begun to see all sorts of things she could make from the used appliances in her shop. Wonderful things. She kept looking in the catalogs and kept being amazed to find they weren't there. My God, she thought, I think I am going to be rich. Only she had made some sort of cross-connection on the silver polisher and quirked off into the Twilight Zone in just under 0.0006 of a nanosecond. She was not, in truth, greatly missed in Haven. The town lay limp at the bottom of a stagnant bowl of air. From the woods behind the Garrick place came the sounds of engines as Bobby and Gardner went on digging. Otherwise, the whole town seemed to doze. 12. Ruth wasn't dozing that afternoon. She was thinking about those sounds coming from Bobby Anderson's place. She, at least, no longer thought of it as the old Garrick farm. And about Bobby Anderson herself. There was a communal well of knowledge in town now, a pool of thought they all shared. A month ago, Ruth would have found such an idea insane. Now it was undeniable. Like the rising, whispering voices, the knowledge was there. Part of it was knowing that Bobby had started all this. It had been inadvertent, but she had set it in motion. Now she and her friend, the friend was a perfect blank to Ruth, she knew about him only because she had seen him out there, sitting on the porch with Bobby, evenings, were working 12 and 14 hours a day, making it worse. She didn't think the friend had any real idea what he was doing. He was somehow outside of the communal net. How were they making it worse? She didn't know. Didn't even know for sure what they were doing. That was also blocked, not just from Ruth, but from everyone in Haven. They would know in time. They would not come to knowledge, but become to it, as the town-wide menstruation of every female between the ages of about 8 and 60 had stopped at about the same time. It had something to do with digging. That was all Ruth could tell. One afternoon, she napped lightly and dreamed Bobby and her friend from Troy were unearthing a great silver cylinder some 200 feet across. As they uncovered more and more of it, she could see a much smaller cylinder, this one steel, perhaps 10 feet across and 5 feet high, protruding nipple-like from the center of the thing. Etched on this nipple was a plus symbol, and as she awoke, Ruth understood. She had dreamed of a gigantic alkaline battery entombed in the earth and granite of the land behind Bobby's house, a battery bigger than Frank Spruce's dairy barn. Ruth knew that whatever Bobby and her friend were digging up in the woods, it certainly wasn't a gigantic, ever-ready, long-life D-cell battery. Except, in a way, she thought that was exactly what it was. Bobby had discovered some huge power source and had become its prisoner. That same force was simultaneously galvanizing and imprisoning the whole town, and it was growing steadily stronger. Her mind whispered,
"You've got to let it go. You've just got to stand back and let it run its course. They have loved you, Ruth. That much is true. You hear their voices in your head like a rising wind lifting October leaves, now not just puffing them and letting them drop, but whipping them into a cyclone. You hear their mind voices, and although they are sometimes garbled and confused, I don't think they can lie. And when these rising voices say they have loved you, still do love you, they are telling the truth. But if you meddle into what's going on here, I think they'll kill you, Ruth. Not Bobby's friend. He's immune somehow. He doesn't hear voices. He doesn't become, except drunk. That's what Bobby's voice says, guard becomes drunk. But as for the rest of them, if you meddle into their business, they'll kill you, Ruth. Gently. With love. So just stand back. Let it happen.